This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we are doing labor and employment law, but focusing on trends with labor relations, unions, and the National Labor Relations Board. That's the NLRB. My guests are labor and employment law attorneys Thomas Lenz, a partner in the law firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, and Romo. He is a member of the Executive Committee of the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar and represents employers. My other guest is Karen Sensor, a partner in the law firm of Weinberg, Roger, and Rosenfeld. She represents unions and working people in litigation and administrative hearings. Both of them appear regularly before the National Labor Relations Board on hearings, and I think you're going to find this a very interesting program. So stick with us. And for those of you who are listening to us live, you'll have a chance to call in and ask some questions, make some comments if you like. This segment of Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding for the program is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Karen and Tom, thank you very much for joining me on the program.
My pleasure, Chuck.
Great to have you here. Tom, the National Labor Relations Board has been in the news a lot lately. It's getting a lot of publicity. What is this all about?
There's been a lot of talk about the NLRB because many people believe that the National Labor Relations Board is on a mission to expand employee rights and, in turn, to intrude upon employers' ability to run their businesses. And at the same time, increasing the opportunities for labor unions to organize a workforce that is in many ways declining in terms of union support.
Mm-hmm. Actually, what is it, if I may say, and correct me if I'm wrong, isn't Walmart now being confronted by a big movement for unionization?
Walmart is being confronted by a big movement for unionization, but more importantly, it's being pressured by a group of Walmart associates without a union who use the name Our Walmart, and it's respect for Walmart associates, which is separate from a request to unionize.
Mm-hmm.
They are looking for certain workplace changes that are independent of getting a union, workplace rights that they believe that they're entitled to regardless of whether or not they have a union. And Walmart, yes, has been in the news a lot lately because of that, and they are facing charges in front of the National Labor Relations Board that have been ongoing and, in fact, a very complex hearing that has been moving from city to city to city based on the location of various practices that are alleged to be unfair.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Such as, and correct me if I'm wrong, such as women were not getting the same pay as men, or am I wrong on that? No, apparently I'm wrong on that, Karen.
I'm thinking about that. I don't know if that one's in there.
I thought that was an issue, but I must be wrong. What about such things as employees' rights in terms of free speech, social media, email, handbooks, that kind of thing? What can employees expect today? How much flexibility do they have? How controlling can management be of what their employees can do in terms of social media, using the email, et cetera, et cetera?
It is an incredibly complex and developing area of law, but what I tell my clients is, in regulating what employees do, you need to stick to regulating what happens in the workplace, and you need to do so consistently.
Mm-hmm.
The Labor Board, in a recent decision, which has received a lot of attention, has presumed that employees have a right to use email in the workplace, their employer's email system, for communication on wages, hours, and working conditions. And while an employer can certainly regulate use of its system, can inspect use of its system, there are going to be, I think, There's going to be greater scrutiny if an employer takes action against an employee because of things he or she says or does via the email system, the computer network generally.
Well, what about this? What if an employee, generally speaking, is using the email system to send, let's say, emails to one's spouse or boy or girlfriend or a relative that has nothing to do with the work in the place of employment? What control can an employer have on that? And by control, I mean discipline or requiring that, hey, you can't do that. Please don't do it anymore. Otherwise, we might have to have some kind of suspension or whatever.
If it's unrelated to wages, hours, and working conditions and unrelated to work tasks, I think the employer has a great deal of leeway in mm-hmm. regulating and prohibiting that activity.
Mm-hmm.
But then there becomes a question of what is the employer's actual practice? Sometimes policy and practice are not consistent. And if an employer allows a certain amount of activity, takes a stronger, stricter view as to what an employee says or does as it relates to wages, hours, and working conditions, there is a potential for a discrimination issue in terms of how those rules are enforced.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where an employer can get into trouble. It's, I think, selectivity in enforcement.
And I would agree with that. One of the major points is that the employer can't regulate union speech more than it regulates other speech. So if employees can talk about what TV show they watched last night, giving money to the United Way or whatever else as part of their email back and forth to each other, then they can't limit what they say about union or organizing mm-hmm. because that's regulating the speech itself as compared to limiting the use of the email system. Mm-hmm. And most employers, I think Tom's completely right, they may have a policy that says no personal use, but over years those policies have degraded in practice mm-hmm. and employees are regularly using the employer email system for personal communications. And once you've broken down that barrier, then it's any personal communication as long as we're not interfering with work time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. When an employer asks me, what do I do when someone's talking about the union on email or even among coworkers in the workplace or handing out flyers, distributing things in the workplace, I say, what do you do about people talking about the basketball game or having a Super Bowl pool or selling Girl Scout cookies? It's got to be handled under the same consistent set of rules.
What are employers then doing when you tell them about this? What are you doing if someone is selling Girl Scout cookies or talking about the Super Bowl at work? What do they then do, if anything, to change their workplace practice?
Most employers, in my experience, do not change their workplace practice. They maybe have a greater sensitivity to the rights of employees. And the response I get most of the time is, we don't want to change our workplace culture. People enjoy interacting mm-hmm. with each other on these different things.
Mm-hmm.
They like buying lottery tickets for, somebody's church raffle or whatever it might be. And to chill that, in effect, chills the culture of the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And that, too, can raise not only legal issues but morale issues, which
that's particularly important.
Exactly.
You don't want the morale to go downhill, certainly. There's been a thing about more and more in handbooks of employers that if you become an employee of my business, you're going to, if we do have some kind of a dispute, you have agreed, if you become an employee, that there will be an arbitration hearing of this. You will not have the right to file a lawsuit and have a potential jury trial, which, of course, is one of the rights that, generally speaking, we have in the state of California, general right originally, to have a right to file a complaint and therefore have a jury trial. Would you both talk a little bit about that? What is going on with arbitration agreements and also in conjunction with class action lawsuits?
So a lot of employers have moved to what they call mandatory arbitration agreements. It's part of the employee handbook. It's required by every employee to sign off on as a condition of employment. So the point where some employers will say, well, you continued to work here even if you didn't sign it, therefore I'm assuming you agreed to my arbitration provision. Mm. And these provisions are very broad. They require the employee to arbitrate every claim so that an employee can bring an administrative claim, for example, with the Department of Fair Employment and Housing or the NLRB, but to prosecute that claim actually has to go into the private arbitration procedure.
Mm.
And in California, the arbitration procedure can actually be pretty costly. The employer has to pay for the entire cost of the arbitration. It's usually before a paid arbitrator or a paid retired judge. They can be fairly expensive. But they move all of these claims out of the court system, mm-hmm. which unburdens the court system, but also privatizes the decision against the employer if there is one reached, so that the employer doesn't face public scrutiny for some of their wrongful actions. The NLRB has taken the position that these arbitration agreements can be valid in some circumstances, but when they prevent employees from taking action together, engaging in a class action lawsuit, that it's prohibited because it violates the employee's Section 7 right under the National Labor Relations Act mm-hmm. to engage in protected concerted activity, because you've told them that they can't engage in that concerted activity. They can only do that activity on their own behalf. And this has created somewhat of a conflict because the NLRB is enforcing this prior NLRB decision, D.R. Horton it's called, and issuing complaints against employers where their handbook does not allow employees to take collective action. But at the same time, the United States Supreme Court has stated a strong preference for arbitration and has been holding up all kinds of arbitration agreements. It's created a conflict between the Courts of Appeals and the National Labor Relations Board in how they enforce these handbook
instances. Let me make sure I understand this then. With respect to, let's say, class action lawsuits, what is the position of the NLRB?
They said that an arbitration agreement can't limit the right of an employee to engage in a class action lawsuit,
all right.
Even if it's a private one. It could in arbitration still as a group. Then it mm-hmm. would still be a collective action and would be valid. Their problem is when the arbitration agreement limits it so that only one employee can bring their claim at a time. They don't have the right to engage in the collective action of enforcing mm-hmm. state or federal law.
So what do you do in that kind of a situation, Karen, if that's the situation? You who represents working people and unions, what do you do?
We file a charge with the NLRB that issues a complaint and goes to hearing regarding the employer's unfair practice of prohibiting Section 7 rights. And at the same time, we file a demand for arbitration and then have a fight in front of an arbitrator, a retired judge, about whether that claim represents one person or if it represents all people or if we have to join other people individually and have a consolidated action. It gets very complicated.
I can see that. Where do you go if that retired judge says, oh, no, you can't have all of these people getting together? Where do you go next?
Well, you actually, it kind of works out badly for everybody, honestly, because then if there's depth within that unit, if you know those people and all the individuals want to do something, you wind up in a situation that we currently had 24 individual arbitrations against the same employer.
I see. Okay, 20, and that was 24 persons for each of the 24 arbitrations.
Yeah, so it's one person for each arbitration, yeah.
Well, that makes that's not a simple matter to deal with all that kind of stuff.
It's not a simple matter for anyone. It's not really working for the employers either, I would venture to guess.
Tom, what do you think about that?
This is an area of great concern for employers, but the position that employers have been taking is that the Supreme Court has blessed arbitration, whether it's unionized or whether it's in the non-union workplace. And it's a way to keep costs down. It's a way to keep disputes out of court. It's a way to have a professional private judge resolve disputes and get things done quicker, because I think everybody knows litigation can last for years in the courts. Arbitration can be resolved sooner. And consistent with California's standards under California law, we want to make sure that arbitration agreements are drafted in a way that satisfies that state law. And to the extent the National Labor Relations Board is trying to intervene in this area, the Supreme Court has blessed, many employers are fighting the NLRB, taking those issues into federal appellate court, and at the same time, you know, pursuing the arbitration remedy.
This is really, really very interesting. What I'm sure there are claims, are there not, by working people, by unions, that if you are restricted to arbitration before a retired judge, and you're limited in what you can do, and you talked about the 24 separate arbitrations, is there a continued complaint by unions and working people that there is a bias favoring the management, favoring the employer, generally speaking, or not?
Well, it's really hard to say because it becomes a very individualized look at what happened in any particular case. Depends on, I would say, a lot of factors. Our office represents a lot of unions and a lot of working people. We deal with a lot of arbitrators and a lot of retired judges on a regular basis. So we're a repeat player, and from that perspective, judges and mediators know that, and they know that they're going to be in front of us. We're going to be in front of them again, regardless of the posture. And so I think that most judges and arbitrators just try to do their best in every individual case.
Well, that's good.
But they
hear.
Are paid for by the employer in these situations.
Well, that's my concern. Yeah, if they're paid by the employer, and who chooses? How is a retired judge or whoever the arbitrator is, how is that person chosen? Is it the employer who chooses that person?
Usually it has to be mutually agreed to, but that can be its own process that can take a while till we find someone that both sides can agree to.
I see. Okay. So it is a give and take, and hopefully, finally, you get somebody that both sides can agree to.
Yeah, if it's going to work, it's got to involve both parties. It can't be dictated.
Well, that's good. That's very good to hear. What about, I know there was one of the things that we talked about before we went on the air, and that I want you to think about this for a moment, and then we'll come back to it. Harassment investigation. Let me come back to that in just a minute. I want to let everybody know this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing a program on labor and employment law focusing on trends with labor relations, unions, and the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB. My guests are Karen Sensor, a partner in the law firm of Weinberg, Roger, and Rosenfeld. My other guest is Tom Lenz, a partner in the law firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rude, and Romo. Tom represents management and employers, and Karen represents unions and workers, and they both spend a lot of time at hearings before the National Labor Relations Board, so we're not only talking about California law, but we're talking about federal law on this particular program. And in a few minutes, if you have a question or comment, I'll give you our local number, and you can call in. So let me come back to my last question to you. Harassment investigation. For example, harassment, I suppose, you know, most people would think in terms of women being sexually harassed in the working place. There must be other, certainly, bases of harassment. Tom, what are we talking about here?
Well, this is an area which has received a lot of attention in recent years because clearly, there are other laws, Title VII, the Fair Employment and Housing Act here in California, and they prohibit discrimination. And there's other laws as well. But what the National Labor Relations Board has done in applying the labor law to these situations is to say to employers, sure, you have a duty to investigate these issues, to try to bring resolution to a complaint of harassment. But where you are crossing the line in the eyes of the National Labor Relations Board is in trying to regulate the investigation process to a point where it chills employee rights. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing this in a case that I am litigating right now that's been pending for, at least 5 years. Where an employer simply told an employee, keep what's going on in the investigation confidential. And the employer takes the position that we have a duty to maintain confidentiality and integrity of the investigation while it's in process. And we do that in order to protect not only the accused, but the accuser as well. And you know, many times employees have things happen in the workplace. They talk to their coworkers about it, and that creates some conflict. So the labor board has said that employees have a right to discuss wages, hours, and working conditions, and that might include things such as a harassment accusation. And by telling the employee, don't talk about this, you are chilling that right to engage in concerted activity, specifically discussing that issue and what occurred leading up to the harassment complaint.
The other part of that is that the union has a duty to represent, and part of that duty to represent is to investigate a grievance that's brought to it. So frequently when there's an allegation of harassment, one employee, sometimes inside the bargaining unit, is going to be or threatened to be disciplined as regarding the outcome of that investigation, if, example, they are the harasser. And so the union has a duty to investigate and to make sure that it has the full facts in order to process the grievance associated with that discipline appropriately. So the other issue that has come about with this is an obligation on the part of the employer to provide witness statements to the union. The National Labor Relations Board has been, say, grappling with this issue as to what has to be provided. The standard for a while had been summaries of what the... summaries of what other employees had said as part of the investigation without names attached to it. And the balancing test on that has been shifting so that the union is entitled to more information so that it can process and handle grievances appropriately.
But the fight hasn't stopped, I presume.
It hasn't, and I think it's important to note that Karen's points are, you know, very well taken in terms of in the unionized context. This is also an issue that comes up in the non-union context. These rights of concerted activity and employer issues with chilling that concerted activity remain equally valid.
If we're talking about a non-union type of situation where some of these rights have been violated, from a practical standpoint, how does a worker who is injured, Karen, how does that person go about trying to get some justice here? Because a lot of some attorneys will do it on a contingent fee basis. Some won't, and most working people can't afford enormous attorney's fees. How do they do this?
That's actually one of the great things about the National Labor Relations Board. The National Labor Relations Board, it costs basically nothing to file a charge. The charge is a form. It can be filled out by an individual, a union, an attorney. Any kind of representative can fill out the charge form. And if the region, in this case, we're in Northern California, it's either Region 32 or Region 20, if they determine that that charge has merit, they issue a complaint, and then they become the prosecuting party.
The NLRB becomes the prosecuting party?
Yes, against the employer. And as compared to, for example, the EEOC or the DFEH, they actually have...
EEOC is...
The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for Title VII issues.
So that's a federal.
Federal.
Yeah.
Or the Department of Fair Employment and Housing at the state level that also enforces anti-discrimination laws. There is no right to sue kind of process. You can't opt out of the system and go into private enforcement. Once a complaint issues, the region, the board, has control of that complaint and processes that complaint to the entire through the entirety. So they provide the attorney and they work the case up, and they prosecute the case.
So the employee, the worker here, does not have the legal obligation to pay an attorney who may be, in effect, prosecuting the rights or proceeding with trying to get some justice for the employee who claims that he or she has been violated by certain practices of the employer.
Right. Now, frequently, though, a lot of people don't know about their rights under the NLRB. They don't know that
they don't.
As a non-union employee that they have equal rights to concerted and protected activity. A lot of people don't even know what the act is about. And so it's hard for them to necessarily connect with the region to make that complaint to begin with. And that's one of the ways that unions and plaintiff side attorneys can help is that they do educate on that issue.
Is there a website that the NLRB has that the average non-lawyer could go to kind of find out, gee, I'd like to know what my rights are through the National Labor Relations Board? Is there a website that people can go to?
www.nlrb.gov.
Well, that's pretty simple.
Doesn't get easier than that.
NLRB.gov. Yeah. Okay. And is it a comprehensive website that gives you that educates you?
Who we are, what your rights are. Those are all.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Subject headings there. There's an app that they have now.
That's wonderful. Yeah,
you can even look up pending cases.
Really?
As well as decisions that go back decades.
That's really marvelous. Okay. Don't forget that, everybody. www.nlrb.gov. If you are having a problem, you as an employee or your spouse or your friend or whatever having a problem, educate yourself somewhat by going to the NLRB website.
And I would suggest that employers do that as well.
Oh, sure.
That there are situations in which businesses, large or small, will need to take steps in some instances to file charges of their own against someone who violated the labor laws, or in some instances, even in an election petition.
Really? Very, very interesting. Okay. Any other websites that you would recommend to the listeners that you feel would be helpful to them in kind of educating themselves about what their employment or employee rights may be? No? Okay. You know, one of the things, if I may suggest this, if you don't mind, one of the things that I have found in all the years I've been doing this program, and it's now I'm in the 32nd year, believe it or not, NOLO. I don't know if you're familiar with NOLO, N-O-L-O. It has produced wonderful books over the years, and I want to make it very clear to all of you, NOLO is not a funder of this program, but it produces wonderful books, and there is... There are some books that NOLO has. These are large paperback books that have the rights of employees, my rights in the working place, et cetera, et cetera. And you don't even have to buy it. Most of these books are available in the consumer sections of public libraries. And frankly, if you are having a problem and you don't know what to do, I highly recommend that you go to the consumer section of your local library and find the NOLO books. I know there's at least one or two on employee rights and employers' obligations, et cetera. And it's a great way to get some kind of basic information about what maybe your next step is if you feel you're having a problem at work. We have 30 seconds left. Actually, we don't have 30 seconds left. So what I'm going to do is, for those of you who are listening to us live, we will continue a second half hour, and I will, in just a minute or so, give the phone number. All right. It is 7:27 and a half at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney, and we're doing a program on labor and employment law. We've been talking about trends with labor relations unions and the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB. I want to give you an opportunity to call in. If you have an employment law question, if you've had a problem at work, whether you are an employee or an employer, I encourage you, join us by calling 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. If you're out of the area and you are listening to us on the internet at www.klw.org, that's the same number for you. I encourage you to call in with your question, your concern, your problem. My guests are very experienced in this area of employment law, beyond, obviously, just dealing with the National Labor Relations Board, et cetera. So take advantage of the fact they're here, 1-415-841-4134. My guests are Karen Sensor, a partner in the law firm of Weinberg, Roger, and Rosenfeld; Thomas Lenz, a partner in the law firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rude, and Romo. They both, Tom represents management and employers. Karen represents workers and unions. They both spend a good deal of time in hearings before the National Labor Relations Board. So I hope that you will call in, ask some questions, make some comments if you like. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and in Marin County. For a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own, and you need to call during normal business hours. That's the best time to do it. And I think you can get human beings on the phone, 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you are in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and lawyer referral service. This is a great way to get some basic information if you're having a legal problem. Call your own. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to try to find someone who's experienced for you. There are a lot of lawyers out there, so hopefully you will get someone for a half an hour consultation who knows what he or she is talking about for a face-to-face interview. With minor exception, the cost will be, for half an hour, anywhere between $25 to $35. That money does not go to the attorney. It goes to the lawyer referral service to support that very fine public service. So I hope you take advantage of it. And, Stephen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The question that I had to pose involves like a bullying. We've seen emails within our workplace, and we're trying to figure out what to do with these emails because people are being accused of being bullied by other coworkers, and it's come to our attention that some of this has occurred as a result of recommendations that may improve an employee's work productivity or change or introduce a new procedure into the workplace. And yet they're being responded to as a form of bullying.
Huh.
I'm happy to listen to the response.
That's very interesting. What city do you work in, Stephen?
We're up in San Rafael.
Oh, yeah? Okay. Well, let me, and this is a private company you're involved with?
Correct.
Okay. Well, if you would turn your radio back up and we'll get some responses. Can he do that? You ready to respond to him? Without asking him any more questions? Okay. Turn your radio up, Stephen, and take the answer on the air. What comments do you have for him, Tom?
Well, bullying is an area of significant discussion. And
we don't have laws yet on bullying, not yet.
There has been one development that I think is noteworthy on the topic in California as it relates to workplace training. But what I would say is, yeah, bullying has not been defined. It often seems to envelop other issues that could be harassment or assault and battery. It could involve a number of different types.
Well, that's physical stuff, assault
correct.
And battery.
But
yeah.
When we're talking about email, yeah, you're probably looking at discrimination. You're probably looking at harassment issues to find something covering it under existing law.
Mm-hmm.
With an employer facing an issue like this, I would say you need to investigate it. You need to find out what's going on, and you need to take steps to remediate it. I mean, I look at bullying as a situation where someone does something to someone else that affects their ability to do their job effectively.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that any employer in the private sector that has at least 50 employees for many years has had a duty to conduct sexual harassment avoidance training. As of
which would include possibly harassment that you've discussed so far?
Not just sexual harassment, but now under change in the law, there is an anti-bullying training component to that that two-hour training session every 2 years for supervisors. So I think any employer needs to investigate, try to solve it, And I would suggest the framework that I mentioned, and certainly train the people to train the management people to avoid these circumstances and to fix them as quickly as possible.
Well, I hope that gives you something, Stephen, to follow through on. Any comments from you, Karen?
I think one thing that's often overlooked in these situations is that even if it doesn't violate state law, that it doesn't rise to the level of harassment or discrimination for a protected class under state law, that the employee handbook may have a guideline as to what acceptable conduct is inside the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And if those emails are going outside of that, it gives a real opportunity to an employee to raise that issue to management without sounding like a whiner, just mm-hmm. looking to enforce mm-hmm. the rule that you created
mm-hmm.
and allow for the investigation to proceed that way. Because an employer should be held to the standards that they're putting out there as to what the workplace is supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And if an employee is feeling that's not what's happening, then they should be raising that with their employer. Mm-hmm.
That's an outstanding point. And when we review employers' policies and handbooks, we want them to have rules in effect that they are going to live by. And certainly if they've enacted a policy, we want that policy to be consistently enforced.
Mm-hmm. All right. The number again, 1-415-841-4134. If you have an employment law question, concern, or something that you would like to share with the audience, that's 1-415-841-4134. And we've got Ann. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, Ann.
Hi. I have a question. So it's really, I'm calling for my daughter. She was working at these two different restaurants, I understand, owned by the same owner. And in December, they bounced a check to her. And then when she came back to work on the last day, week of the month, they had closed the doors. In other words, none of the employees knew that I'm going to pull over here because I'm driving.
You be careful. I don't want to have any accidents. And, okay, you okay now?
Yeah, that's better.
All right. That's better. Okay, so one of the restaurants was closed. The employees didn't know that, and your daughter was given a check that bounced. Is that right?
Right, and then come to find out, the next payroll one also bounced. It issued into her account and then bounced. So she got a charge because it was auto deposit.
Yeah.
So she also got charged for the bounced check, right? So I'm calling just to see what the recourse is for that, and she said the employees think that they actually sold the restaurant because they had, like, prior to that, in the 2 months prior, they had some people coming through and appraising and, doing the stuff they do when they're getting ready to sell a restaurant.
So your daughter has not yet seen an attorney to sit down and talk about what her rights may be?
No.
What county does your daughter live in?
She lives in Oakland, Alameda County, but she's working in San Francisco.
Yeah. My suggestion, if I may, Ann, I think it's very important for someone who has a problem like this, considering how valuable and accessible lawyer referral is through whether it's the Alameda County Bar Association Lawyer Referral Panel or San Francisco. Your daughter should look to calling one or the other and getting an appointment to sit down with an employment law attorney who represents employees for half an hour, and she'll pay, I think, whatever county she wants to do this in, whatever lawyer referral service she wants to do it in, it's $35, which is a great way to do it. So, but what comments do you have for Ann, for her daughter, Karen?
Well, the Labor Commissioner is a great resource on this. Through the California Labor Commissioner's office, there's lots of offices to file a claim in. You can file a claim for the failure to pay all wages due at the time of separation if they've closed up shop.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a penalty that goes with it of up to 30 days' wages for each day that the wages were not paid. And there's also a bounce
really?
Check provision.
Really? That much of a penalty?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And there's a bounce check penalty, so a provision as well. So the employer has to pay the employee in funds that can be used.
Mm-hmm.
And the best resolution for Ann's daughter would be to have those charges reversed or borne by the employer because
sure.
it's the employer who forced them to
of
be
course.
Incurred.
Of course.
And so I would think that filing a claim with the labor commissioner is probably the fastest and cheapest way to get that problem resolved.
And your daughter can Google the California Labor Commissioner's office and find out what she needs to do, Ann.
Okay, great.
Yeah, Tom, please.
I would add to that The wage and hour laws in California actually have a criminal component, and it's not always enforced, but I think employers need to take very seriously their obligations to pay not only complete wages, but timely wages. And there is always that potential issue out there of, you know, being criminally prosecuted as well.
Yeah.
And the labor commissioner can be found on the Internet, and I believe that's under the DLSE.
DLSE, okay.
Yeah, Department of Labor Standards Enforcement.
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
Okay, and you did say that this restaurant, actually, there were two restaurants owned by the same people. Is that what you understood?
Yes.
And
is
one restaurant still going ongoing?
One closed in December, and the next one closed in January.
Ah, so both have closed.
Yeah.
There may be a bankruptcy issue here, possibly. Who knows? But certainly follow through with what my guests have said, would you?
Yes. Does that mean if there's a bankruptcy, does that mean that she has no recourse?
What do you say on that one, Tom?
Well, the well may be dry in terms of available money,
okay.
But
okay.
That might mean filing a proof of claim in a bankruptcy proceeding, but it doesn't change the potential illegality of, failing to tender a good check.
Yeah.
So in that case, then what would be the steps if it turned out to be that, when you say you get in line, I guess is what you're saying?
Essentially, yes. And you would, in a bankruptcy court, file a document called a proof of claim where you state that you are owed money by this individual whose situation, what they would call the estate, is in bankruptcy because they can't pay the obligations that have come due.
Okay,
Anne. Good luck to your daughter.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's completely switching channels here, but you guys were talking before about employee handbooks. What are the requirements for having an employee handbook?
They're generally pretty broad. The employer can put whatever in their handbook they like as long as it doesn't otherwise violate state or federal law. The main component, though, is if an employer wants it to be enforceable, they need to distribute it to the employees and make sure that they're actually enforcing it. They can't pick and choose when to enforce it, and they can't say, oh, I have it, but it's in the back office and you've never seen it. So if you'd like the employee to follow those rules, you actually have to provide those rules to the employee.
Yeah. But you're not required to do that.
Well, I would say that there are a couple of policies that you are required to have in writing. I mean, most workplace policies are matters of discretion for employers, and as Karen described, if you have it, you need to consistently enforce it. California law actually requires employers to have a policy on sexual harassment, which defines harassment, which states that it's prohibited, which states what will happen in the event harassment occurs or is alleged and how it will be handled, and even gives employees information on where they can go if they don't feel the process has been followed within the company. Also, if a company is of a certain size, they're required to have a family and medical leave policy as well.
One other thing I want to mention to you, Anne, with regard to your daughter. If your daughter discovers that the former owners of these restaurants are in the process of filing for bankruptcy, at the end of this month, I don't know if you've ever listened to the program before, but we do on a regular basis, usually the last Wednesday of the month, we will do, while I'm doing a live program on the air, we will also have in the conference room here at the station, we will have some attorneys for what's called Call a Lawyer Night. The next day, the following day, which would be a Thursday, and that will be March 26th, usually, and I think it will happen again on March 26th, that Thursday coming up, Leon Baer, who's a certified specialist in bankruptcy law, makes himself available by his 800 number in L.A. to take calls on bankruptcy issues between 8 and noon. So if your daughter finds out that her former employers are filing for bankruptcy, I would recommend that she listen to the program on the 25th, and reference will be made to Leon Baer's 800 number so that she can call and speak to him the following day on Thursday, March 26th, between 8 and noon. Okay?
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. All right, Ann. Thank you for calling. Right. Bye-bye. Thanks. All right, Debbie, welcome to the program. Debbie.
Hello?
Hi, Debbie. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah. Are you driving?
Yes, I am.
Are your windows down? Because if you can roll up your window, it will help the quality of your voice here.
No, I'm sorry. They are already up.
Okay, well, go ahead. What's your question?
Okay, my question is, I was hired for a job where I would be working between two different offices in two different cities. That was the agreement. Now, one of those offices has closed, and so now I'm required to commute to the other office 5 days a week, which is an hour commute further each way and a lot more gas and travel time. And I'm wondering, is there any compensation for me for that, or is that just something I'm going to have to deal with?
Okay, I'm going to ask you now to turn up your radio and get the answer on the air. One of the things I think, Debbie, is very important that you understand, the State Bar's ethics rules, when we get a specific question like that, do not permit my guest to give specific legal advice. However, what we do is, with a question like that where you are really asking for specific legal advice, my guest will try to give you some direction of what you should do next in terms of trying to figure out what's going on here. And it may well be worth it for you also in the county where you live, or perhaps the county where you work, to get an appointment through the lawyer referral service of the Bar Association in that county to speak with an employment law attorney who represents employees. And for half an hour, with minor exception, you'll pay $25 to $35. But what thoughts do you have, Karen, with respect to this woman who, Debbie, who's obviously now spending extra time, gas money, et cetera, et cetera?
It's a difficult situation, because when an employee is employed at two job sites, the employer has an obligation to pay them to travel between those two job sites if that's part of the regular job of the day. If you start in one and go to the other, you're most likely on the clock on the time going in between the two. But if your commute to your general workplace is not generally paid time, and so it's really just a question of whether you can negotiate something better for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. Commuting time, as a general matter, is not compensable. But yeah, once it becomes part of the workday, as Karen described, it's something where issues do arise and payment may be due.
So, Debbie, you're in a situation where maybe you don't have any recourse. But again, I'm in favor of people trying to educate themselves, and I think it would be worth it for you to make a small investment to meet with an employment law attorney who represents employees and see what you can get face-to-face. Maybe that it would be a great learning experience for you. All right, Jim, welcome to the program.
Hello, this is a brief tangential comment which you may not be too happy with.
Uh-oh.
I would like to say that so far this evening you've taken at least two calls from people who are driving, and I think that from a public safety point of view that is entirely reprehensible to encourage people to talk on the phone, even hands-free, although it may be technically legal in the state of California, because all of the research indicates that driving while talking on the phone, whether or not hands-free, is the functional equivalent of drunk driving. Please do not encourage this practice.
Well, Jim, thank you for your comments. They're obviously very thoughtful. I'm a great believer also in actually people not talking on their cell phones, whether they have an earpiece or not. I think the fact of the matter is I cannot control what everybody is doing. And my feeling about this is this. If people are going to call into the program while they're driving and they know they're going to make a call, I think it's incumbent upon them to pull over if they can get off the freeway, or if they're on the freeway, get off the freeway, get on a surface street, and not try to do two things at the same time from a very important safety factor. So, Jim, I thank you for your call. I don't know that this is reprehensible. I don't agree with that. I am a great believer in consumer protection, and I do not like myself to see people talking on, even if it's an earpiece, let alone holding a handphone and, of course, a cell phone to their face while they're talking. That is illegal. But I'm not in favor of that myself, Jim, but I feel that people have to have some responsibility for what they're doing when they are going to call. And so I recommend any of you who will be calling from your car, if you know you're going to be calling, please pull off the freeway, pull over if you're on a surface street, and stop so you can call and not have a problem. Thank you, Jim, for your call. All right, we've got Peter. Welcome to the program.
Oh, yeah. Hello.
Yeah.
Hello. Yeah, Peter here. Please, I don't know if my subject, like, fits your discussion today. I have the case of wrongful termination by the union from the employment. And I've been, you know, pushed out from the employment by a construction union. And I think basically it's like age discrimination. The union gave four reasons. All of them are bogus. And the main one is even like a forgery. They were claiming that I refused two dispatches, and I have already proved that it didn't happen, that they forged it because of the phone records. You know, nobody can dispatch you if they don't call you. And my case is with Department of Industrial Relationships of State of California.
You do have a claim with the commissioner, Labor Commissioner's office. Is that right?
I beg your pardon.
You do have a case before the Labor Commissioner's office.
I was still apprentice. I was like late apprentice, and my case is handled by sub-department of apprenticeship standards. And they have it since June of last year, but basically it's not moving.
Well, let me get some comments for you, Peter. This is, if you will turn your radio back up, let me get some comments for you, because maybe this will help you with the next step that you might take. Go ahead, if you would, Tom, please.
Certainly. Hello, Peter. I think you're in a difficult situation in terms of the Department of Apprenticeship Standards and maybe the speed with which they handle your issue. They certainly do handle questions involving you know, how apprentices are treated, how apprenticeship programs are run, and so forth. But another thing that comes to mind as I hear what you're talking about is the possibility if a union has caused you to lose employment or has treated you in a way which is arbitrary, capricious, discriminatory, you could have a situation where the National Labor Relations Board investigates and or prosecutes an unfair labor practice charge brought against that union. It's a high standard to meet to find that a union has acted unlawfully, but it is theoretically possible. So the process that was described, the filing of an unfair labor practice charge form, could trigger that. The government would assign an investigator, and if merit is found to the case, the government would prosecute that case.
I would actually add two things to that. First, it sounds like, Peter, from the timing that you're talking about, that this occurred more than 6 months ago, and that is a jurisdictional bar for the NLRB to act.
Oh, too bad.
That there is a statutory limitation for events to have occurred within the prior 6 months. But depending on the union that you're talking about, they most likely have an internal appeals procedure as well. And so reading your international union constitution or the bylaws of your local may give you another route that you could challenge the decision that was made or kind of push on the decision that was made.
What would you also recommend him to do at this point and to try to get some direction from perhaps a lawyer to help him perhaps focus on something. What would you suggest at this point, Karen?
Well, the referral service probably would work to find an attorney who does employment law, because it sounds more like of an employment issue than a labor issue,
yes.
Although I can't really tell for sure from the description.
Yeah. Peter, if you have not done it, I'm hoping that this will be helpful to you. Depending on what county you've been working in, depending on where you live, there's a bar association, a county bar association, lawyer referral service. I think what we are saying is you should, if you haven't done this already, you should contact your county's bar association, lawyer referral service. Tell them basically what the problem is, and they will try to find someone who's experienced in this area, and it may be an employment law attorney who represents employees, to make set up a half an hour consultation for you. It is a great way to educate yourself in terms of where the pitfalls may be, where the good things may be, et cetera, et cetera. So I highly recommend it, and it's certainly, with minor exception, as I mentioned, you'll pay no more than $25 or $35 for a half an hour consultation. It's a great investment of your time and money. So good luck to you. And we're going to have time for one more caller, and that's Karen. Karen, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Good evening.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is, what is the statute of limitation on some of the bullying issue, please? Thank you.
Statute of limitations on bullying issues. That's a little bit overly broad. Can you give us a specific of what the bullying is?
Without going into specifics, maybe discrimination.
On what basis? That you're a woman?
No.
Age? Age?
No, it's not specific to age or yes.
Well, okay. Obviously, we don't have the time. Turn your radio back up. Let's say generally discrimination, whatever it may be, Tom.
Typically, with a discrimination issue, you have roughly a year in which to file an administrative complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
That's a federal commission.
Correct, or the Fair Employment and Housing Commission. But going back to something we discussed a little while ago, there is no specific definition of bullying that is prohibited by law. So it really is going to depend upon the details of this situation.
Right, and there's only harassment or discrimination in the eyes of the law if it goes to one of the protected characteristics. So general meanness in the workplace is just not covered. It has to be tied to one of these protected characteristics: age, race, sex, national origin, discrimination, disability, veteran status, one of those other protected characteristics.
And Karen, what I'd like to also encourage you to do, if you haven't done this yet, is contact your local county bar association lawyer referral service and get an appointment to meet with an employment law attorney for half an hour, an employment law attorney who represents employees, and get some basic information. It's a small investment, but it may be very valuable for you. So that's what I would suggest that you do. And I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Unfortunately, the time has been flying. Thank you very much for coming up here from Southern California, Tom.
It's always my pleasure.
Tom Lenz is a partner in the law firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rude, and Romo. Thanks again, Tom. And Karen Sensor, thank you for coming over here from Oakland.
Great to
have you here. Karen is a partner in the law firm of Weinberg, Roger, and Rosenfeld. And great to have you both on the program.
Thank you, Chuck.
Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. This segment of Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding for the program is provided by the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. All right. Next week, we're going to have the topic of landlord-tenant laws, issues, and disputes. My guests will be landlord-tenant attorneys James Coy Driscoll and Mark Seidenfeld. It will also be our landlord-tenant call a lawyer night, where you can speak to a landlord-tenant lawyer off the air at 1-800-525-9917. I hope you will call us both either on the air or off the air for call a lawyer night for landlord-tenant. And that's next week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Chuck Finney.